welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace's Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. And starting this week and continuing throughout the month of November, the Global Campus is offering our online course on conflict analysis. And the main instructor in that course is Jeff Helsing. He's the Associate Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP. And he will also be my co-host for this podcast throughout the month. So Jeff, it's great to have you on the show. Our guest for today's show is Candace Karp. She is a senior program officer here at USIP, working primarily on countering violent extremism, or CVE. And she comes to USIP after having spent many years working with the United Nations in Afghanistan and the Palestinian territories. So Candace, thank you so much for joining us today. We're also joined today by several listeners from around the world. And we invite those of you who are tuning in online to connect with our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, who will be moderating your questions and chatting it up with you during the broadcast. And so we really look to you, our listeners, to help us guide the conversation. So please notify Vanessa if you have a question or a comment by texting her or clicking the raise hand button on your webinar control panel, and she will read your question or comment on your behalf, or she can unmute you and we can actually bring your voice into the show and you can ask your question directly. So let's get started. I'd like to start with you, Candace, to learn a little bit more about what you do here at USIP and what countering violent extremism actually means. And then after that, Jeff, maybe you could tell us about how Candace's work links up and connects with the main topics that we're looking at this week in the course, which is what is conflict and how is it changing? So Candace, what is countering violent extremism and what is the nature of this work?
Well, for the Academy, the practicalities are working with the Hidayah Center out in Abu Dhabi, and USIP and the Hidayah Center engage stakeholders in the sectors of education, community engagement, and media, in order to impart some skills that they can use to deal with, overcome extremists in their communities.
And when you say deal with or overcome extremists, can you use interchangeably countering violent extremism with preventing violent extremism? Are they the same thing or are they different?
I'd say they're either or. I think that if you can prevent it and develop strategies to do so, that's terrific. But for some communities, the bull has charged and we're beyond preventing and we're now trying to counter it.
And as some of the work that you did with the United Nations in Afghanistan, Palestinian territories, other places, I assume you were exposed to what folks would consider violent extremism. And what does that actually look like? How is that different than just violence?
My own personal view of what a violent extremist looks like is an inability to recognize any other point of view other than your own, to reject other points of view with violence, and to be driven by a very narrow interpretation of an issue. Mm-hmm.
So, Jeff, what are your thoughts on that, and how does some of this work on CVE connect with what we're looking at in the course this week?
Well, I think for this course in particular, if you're going to look at countering violent extremism, or you're going to look at any community work in any society where you're trying to understand violence or the predilections to violence or the capacity for violence, it is critical to understand the conflict dynamics. So what this course will focus on is actually analyzing conflict. And it's not just about understanding the place where there may be violent extremism or the potential for violent extremism. It's understanding the dynamics and potential for conflict. And so what Candace is working on fits with the kind of need we have for conflict analysis. And the other thing I I would also add is that even though we're going to start looking at the changing nature of conflict and we're going to take a bit of a broader view to start the course with, I want to remind everyone in the course that in fact, as you think about the broader issues, keep in mind that there are very important needs to analyze the situation on the ground. And so Candace's experience in Afghanistan, I think, reflects both a kind of broader view, having worked with the United Nations and worked at a national level, but also she's worked on the ground in conflict situations. So we really want to keep that perspective as we go through the course.
So I want to back up a little bit before we delve deeper into conflict analysis and what it looks like, not only what we're sharing here in the course, but also Candace from your experience. But to back up a little bit, how did you find yourself in this line of work, working in conflict-affected communities? What motivated you or inspired you to start working in this field?
I was writing a PhD in the history department out at the University of Queensland, and I was looking at American diplomatic strategy towards the Arab-Israeli conflict between 1947 and 1967. And as I was writing my chapter on 1947 to 1949 events in Jerusalem, the Second Intifada started. And to be a history student and have the opportunity to actually work in your field is quite unique. So I submitted my thesis and I flew to Israel and got a job with the UN mediator to the peace process.
And what was the transition like into that work? Were you surprised by anything? Were there things that were very predictable? What was that experience like for you?
I think the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unfortunately, is very predictable, which makes the absence of a solution all the more tragic. But work in Afghanistan is inherently unpredictable. So if I can compare and contrast the two areas where I've worked, I'd say that that's the biggest difference between the two.
What's unpredictable about Afghanistan, or what do you think makes that conflict unpredictable?
To be honest with you, first of all, our inability to truly understand what it is. I think that anyone who comes to you and says they're an expert is, it's not quite the case. I think the longer you stay, the less you understand. I can count on one hand the people I would truly consider to be experts. And I think that we had to be honest with ourselves. We understand maybe 20% of what's happening in that country. And that 20% has been manufactured for our consumption. And by us, I'm talking of not just the UN, but the entire international community.
Manufactured for our consumption. That's an interesting phrase. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
The Afghans are incredibly savvy, very shrewd, and the situation isn't always as it seems. And the trick is to find a wider group of stakeholders as possible to understand the conflict while recognizing that because of the resources we bring to the conflict, we may not always be led down the true path of what the conflict is actually about.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way in which you felt you could have been better prepared?
No, not necessarily. I think that there are certain limitations to being an international in Afghanistan. I think Afghans are still quite, not hostile, but I think the powers that be in Afghanistan think that these are relationships that are best managed by Afghans. I would certainly adhere to that understanding. And I think that our presence has exacerbated a failure to manage relationships in Afghanistan.
So I want to go back to this phrase about kind of manufactured for our consent, our meaning many organizations, institutions, agencies that are operating, intervening in Afghanistan. And, you know, you've got a great deal of experience in these types of situations, not just in Afghanistan, but as you mentioned earlier in the Palestinian territories. So in terms of conducting a conflict analysis, one of the things that the students in the course this week will be doing is conducting an organizational self-assessment based off of a fictional country that they're introduced to in the course. So they go through a series of questions that, again, allow them to go through this self-assessment process. So from your work and your experience, have you conducted a conflict analysis before arriving on the ground in these countries? Were you encouraged to do this kind of self-assessment by, you know, your organization that you were working for or other counterparts in the country?
Well, I have a conflict analysis for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'd studied the conflict, done a lot of archival research into the origins of the conflict. In terms of Afghanistan, that wasn't the case. You know, you can read a lot of books, but when you're sent down to Kandahar to be a political affairs officer, it's such a localized conflict. It looks different from province to province. I would argue that in Uruzgan and Helmand province in 2008, there were actually three different types of insurgencies, and not necessarily anything to do with Pakistan. So I think the key was to be aware of the absence of knowledge and to talk to a lot of people to try and decipher what conflicts actually were.
Yeah, I would add one thing is you mentioned the Palestinian territories. I think also as somebody who spent a lot of time in the region and who studied that conflict, in order to really understand the relationships and the dynamics of a place, you need to be very open to a much broader understanding of who the stakeholders are and how they perceive their own identity. So we tend to think of Palestinians as being a group of people who live in the West Bank or live in Gaza, or the Palestinian communities who are in Jerusalem or in the state of Israel, without necessarily understanding that in some ways they often identify themselves as coming from a particular town or village or community. I was amazed at having spent quite a bit of time working with Palestinians over the years about how much they viewed each other by the identity of coming from, say, Jenin in the north or Hebron in the south. And those dynamics and how they viewed each other and how they related to each other form the basis in many ways of how they got on and how they interacted. And not understanding that and seeing things very sort of monolithically puts you at a great disadvantage if you're going to work in a particular place, and you have less credibility to be able to relate to them without understanding and appreciating those dynamics.
Candace, how does your experience in the Palestinian territories compare with what Jeff just shared?
The focus of the office I worked in was really the peace process and trying to sustain what was left of the Oslo peace process. This was early 2002, 2003. The Palestinians, at that time, there was still unity over the end state, the desired end state. Question of how to get there was debated. And certainly within groups such as Hamas, the question as to how they would resist Israeli occupation was debated as well. But I'd say on the whole, it was homogeneous if you chose not to examine the sorts of differences that Jeff speaks of. But in terms of Palestinian nationalism, Palestinian statehood, it was a fairly predictable conflict to look at.
Which is one of the reasons why it's important to think about different levels of analysis. That analysis is not simply throwing a particular framework over a problem and just looking at it one-dimensionally. So one of the things that we're going to do over the course of the next few weeks is try and understand that you can bring analysis and assessment to bear in different ways, and you get different valuable information by understanding what level you're looking at. So absolutely, the if you look at a conflict or the drivers of conflict at a national level, you may get a different sense of the conflict dynamics than if you look at the a level that is much more localized.
You just mentioned drivers of conflict, and this is a concept that we'll look at in one of the future sessions in the course. But since you brought it up now, could you explain a little bit about what you mean by drivers of conflict?
Conditions, specific issues, problems, perceptions that people have that may motivate people to engage in violence or seek certain types of political, social, or economic change. As people work to change their situation, are there certain factors that drive them more to take up violence? And these can be structural issues. It can be things related to poverty, inequity in the societies, the lack of access to justice. It can be something more immediate, such as a rise in prices or a rise in unemployment. So there's a lot of different types of drivers that may be more important at certain times rather than other times.
So I see our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, tells us we have a question or comment from someone online.
We do. We have a comment question from Dunson Staples. It seems that conducting an analysis of a conflict by speaking with people who live in a country where conflict transformation work is being done would require a great deal of trust building. Did Candace find this to be true during her time in Afghanistan and Israel-Palestine? If trust building is crucial to learning about the dynamics of a conflict and conducting conflict analysis, how do you go about building that trust?
Talking to people. Starts pretty in a pretty basic way. You talk to as many people as you possibly can. You're discreet with information when they want you to be. You advocate on their behalf when they want to, when they want you to do so. I can't begin to tell you how many conversations I had with farmers talking about their yields, their crop yields, just to develop a relationship, particularly in places like Helmand. There's no one answer. It's about trying to build relationships, manage relationships.
You know, you talk about having conversations around crop yields. Are there other kind of cultural elements that help in that trust building process? So I'm thinking about Greg Mortensen and Three Cups of Tea, and yes, okay, there's a whole nother story to his journey, but are there other cultural elements that help, that have helped you build those relationships and establish that trust?
Yeah, the most effective way was often being asked by Afghan men, by Afghan male interlocutors, whether I would ever consider marrying an Afghan man. And I would say certainly not, because my father would never stand for it. I said for me to marry outside my faith would not be permissible in Shea Candace. And far from alienating them, they totally respected it, because for them, my father's position was no different to their position. They would certainly never let their daughters marry beyond the faith. So that was always a very interesting way to create a dynamic that was honest and also a little humorous.
Now, was that a response that you knew you wanted to provide prior to having these conversations? Or was it something that over the course of a few conversations, you were like, oh, this is probably the best way to reply to that question?
No, it was instinctive.
Yeah, it's interesting, the whole question about faith, because is very important, because identity does make a difference. And it's not about competing or conflicting identities. There's a respect oftentimes for sharing the key parts of one's identity. And I think, you know, the whole notion of the three cups of tea, or just sitting down and taking the time to share something about yourself, is the important lesson from that. And there's, and as Candace talked about, sharing one's faith or what's important in one's own story, narrative, identity, is a way of creating a common bond. It's humanizing the discussion in a way, and that can be very important. The other thing I think also, and in some ways, you know, talking about crop yields or agricultural issues, because I've had some similar conversations in which it's important sometimes just to let people tell their stories and talk about their problems. And, you know, in a sense, you become a listener. I mean, yes, it's a talking process, but just listening and enabling somebody to be heard or to vent about their frustrations or problems and so on can be very important. I remember being with a Palestinian colleague, and we were in a small village sort of outside of Nablus, and he, as a Palestinian, had written a book about nonviolence, and he was a nonviolent advocate. And I remember this older gentleman came up to him and just went off on him by saying, "Well, what's wrong with violence?" And it would have been easy just to dismiss this man and say, you know, well, you know, violence doesn't get you anything, or there are better ways of really advocating for change through nonviolence. But that would have, to just have a quick retort would not have been productive. So we actually sat down and had a discussion about it because he wanted to be heard. And then by his being heard, it enabled us to then talk about our perspective. And I think he was richer for the conversation that wouldn't have happened had we not taken the time to sit down and talk about, you know, violence versus nonviolence and really turn the conversation to, okay, what are you trying to achieve and so on, and begin to have a very meaningful discussion about achieving real change.
I'm hearing a lot of emphasis being placed on the importance of listening. And from my own perspective, coming from the United States, I feel like growing up, I was steeped in the skill set of talking and debating and arguing to win something or convince somebody, but never any formal or even kind of non-formal program around how to listen effectively. And so I know that you all can only speak to your specific experiences within the larger peace building enterprise or field, but how do you think the peace building field, or at least the parts that you've been a part of, how well do you think we are at listening?
Well, I think it's easy to talk about listening as a skill. And I think in the course of this, these next few weeks, we're going to talk more about that. What I would say is that at times we go through the motions of listening, because I think in the peace building field, there is an acknowledgement that yes, listening is very important, but there's good, hard listening where you really have to invest time and effort, and you have to go find the farmer, or you have to go find people that you might not otherwise engage with, and you have to listen to them and not just listen to those who are easiest to listen to, those who you know, Candace was talking about, you know, Afghans sometimes controlling a narrative or the perception of their conflict. I mean, people aren't dumb, and so they know that if outsiders come in, who have resources, who may be of help, oftentimes they tell us what we want to hear. And so are we listening in that regard, or are we simply becoming a vessel for somebody's agenda? And so the key is to is not just to listen to those it's easiest to listen to, but then go out and seek other perspectives. Seek those from other who have other potential perspective, so that one gets a fuller picture of a particular situation or a particular problem, and not just do what's easiest. Now, that requires an investment of time. It requires a sustained effort, as opposed to just showing up and you know, going through a checklist and saying, well, I've done a good assessment because I listened to, you know, 20 different people, even if they're the same 20 people that, you know, your colleague listened to 2 weeks ago.
Does that resonate with your experience?
Absolutely. It's about listening and then cross-checking every piece of information with as many stakeholders as you can get your hands on. I'll talk to anyone about anything. I don't care what the topic is. But But the idea is to develop relationships with as wide a group of stakeholders as possible in order to bounce ideas off, narratives off, to better understand what's going on. And even then, you need to be wary. Perhaps you don't understand it as well as you would like.
So I want to go back to this a concept of conflict drivers that you talked about earlier, Jeff, and it touches a bit on listening versus deep listening, hearing things or listening to things that are easy to hear or listen to versus things that are difficult. I would assume that when you're trying to get information, gather information around what the drivers of conflict are in a given situation, that some folks may be apprehensive to share that kind of information. One, because it might get them in trouble, it might put them in danger, or at being an outsider, if you are intervening in their country, to speak to some of these issues, they just may not feel comfortable to talk about these kinds of things. Has that been the case for you, Candace, doing this work about when you're actually trying to get at what are the drivers of the conflict in this community or in the situation where it has taken a long time to really get people to speak authentically about these things as opposed to at a very shallow level?
It takes time and you can push, but then I think there's a point where you must recognize that pushing will be counterproductive. And if they don't want to tell you, then they don't want you to engage in the issue. And if they don't want you to engage, then there's a good reason for that. And you should really respect that.
Yeah, we're not pollsters. So you can't just show up and start asking questions and go down a list. People will share with you when they trust you. You have to develop, if not a relationship, you at least have to develop for them a sense of who you are, who you represent, and they have to believe that there's value in sharing with you, and that you will protect them, and that's part of earning trust.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace's Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. My co-host for this entire month on the podcast series is Jeff Helsing. He's the main instructor in the course we're offering this month on the Global Campus on conflict analysis. And our guest today is Candace Karp. She's a senior program officer here at USIP and has recently joined USIP, having spent many years working at the United Nations. We also have several listeners online. We'd love them to chime in with their questions, comments, stories around conducting conflict analysis in various contexts. We've been talking a lot about listening and hearing from people's stories to get their perspectives, to get at these drivers of conflict. We'd love to hear from folks listening online about what their experience has been on any of those issues. And our producer, Vanessa, says we have a question or comment.
We have two questions. We're going to start with Gary, who's brave enough to actually try to join us online. So,
Gary,
you are able to talk if you can hear us. Go ahead.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Good to hear you.
All right. Well, fantastic technology. Thanks. It's a fantastic conversation, really interesting, and clearly a lot of experience from the field, which is really, really useful. As a researcher, I wonder about how we know when we have spoken to enough people. I know that you intuitively may get a sense eventually. I've got a lay of the land. I understand. I've spoken to enough people to really understand the issue. And obviously, you can always keep speaking to more people. But you know, how can we systematize that, or how can we understand that better without, you know, there's no rule, and so we're not going to be able to say this number of people is important or have to be spoken to. But how do we figure out how we know when we've spoken to enough people to really understand an issue?
I think that, you know, the end game of all this talking is to actually develop a narrative and fight for it, and then try and develop some policy prescriptions for a UN political mission in Afghanistan. That was always the end game. And if you feel comfortable as the political officer in the field with a particular narrative and you're comfortable fighting for it, or advocating on its behalf or trying to explain it, then I think that's a pretty good indicator of whether you think you've spoken to enough people.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think there's a lot of thought, particularly among those in institutions that have developed fairly comprehensive frameworks to do this kind of analysis. There's always a hesitation to make a judgment based on, in some ways, what you said, that, you know, have we gone far enough? Do we know enough? Have we got enough information? And if we made the correct causal linkages between the information we have and the behavior we're trying to change or the change we're trying to achieve, and that requires, I think, sort of not just the narrative that Candace talked about, but also sharing and vetting this with others, that this is part of what a good organization will do is provide resources, expertise that will enable this kind of analysis to be part of or to be sort of filtered through lessons learned, best practices, experience of others that will help in sort of inform the judgment as to, you know, whether this is good, a good assessment or not.
Okay. Greg Phelps has a question that's going to take us back to the topic about listening. He said, that's a very powerful insight about listening. Are listening skills specifically taught to conflict management practitioners, or are they just learned through experience?
I was thinking the same thing, so thanks for, for that question.
Listening can certainly be taught, and it is a skill that can be developed. It is a skill that can be modeled. It can be practiced. And in fact, we have some of our trainers or particularly good in really teaching the skill of good active listening. And the reason why you think of it as a skill is because active listening requires an engagement, requires participation on the part of the listener. So that's why it's a skill that can be developed as opposed to an attitude about what you're listening to. You engage. There are certain ways of asking questions. There are certain ways of following up or the way in which you hear what somebody says or make sure you understand what somebody says. So that all of that can be really developed as a particular and very, very important skill.
Candace, did you in any of your work find yourself listening to certain perspectives or hearing certain things that were very difficult for you to hear? You know, for example, you know, the work that you did with the UN, you personally analyzed the implications of the construction of the Israeli security barrier along and within the West Bank. And, you know, don't need to get into your particular perspectives on that, but, you know, that's a very political contentious issue, obviously, within Israel and Palestine. And so when you're hearing all these various perspectives on the implications of that separation barrier, how do you remain neutral or objective in what you're hearing? And is that even possible?
I think it's a discipline, but I think the nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one, and I think it's the same for all conflicts. I think there's a very, very much a definite time frame when you yourself should be in the middle of it. And I think it's best if you take yourself out of it after a couple of years, a few years. I spent 7 years in Afghanistan. I think in retrospect, that was way too long. But I think that knowing when enough is also a discipline that's important.
So you said, how many years did you spend in Afghanistan?
7.
And you said you feel like that was too long.
Yes.
Why?
Because by the end of it, I was the person rolling my eyes mm-hmm. in the back of the room. When you hear this initiatives, the wheel turns. You hear one initiative And then a few years later, you hear the same initiative because, you know, people have moved on and, oh, let's try this. But you're the person in the back of the room who remembers the first time around. And while it's good to have that continuity, it's never good to be the person at the back of the room rolling their eyes.
Well, you're welcome with open arms here at USIP. So I want to touch a little bit on the changing nature of conflict, because that's something that the learners in the course will spend a lot of time this week looking at. And one of the concepts that's introduced is this idea of complex conflicts. So one of the instructors in the course, Matt Levenger, has explained that since the end of World War II, we've seen a shift away from interstate wars, and that most of the deaths in these conflicts come from battlefield deaths that are occurring in wars between two different states, two or more states. Now we're seeing more intra-state conflicts, and we're seeing the emergence of what he refers to as complex conflicts that involve multiple borders, multiple countries, non-state actors, crime and corruption and trafficking. For both of you, Jeff and Candace, what have complex conflicts looked like in your work? And is that a useful term to use as we see these changing trends in deadly conflict?
Yeah, I think, well, I guess complex conflicts, I suppose it makes sense, although in some cases they can be about very simple issues. And what I mean by that is a simple desire for a freedom, a desire for justice, a desire for equity. And I think that there's also, I don't think you can divorce the legacy of the state-to-state conflicts or the broader international context from these interstate conflicts. And that's oftentimes how locals perceive them. So if you're in many places in the Middle East, there is a recognition that there's a legacy of the Cold War. There's a legacy of the period of colonialism that is very difficult to get past. And in the past itself has a strong hold on some of the conflict dynamics. So in that sense, I think it's complex because there's a lot of different actors and there's a lot of different goals and objectives that exist among peoples, but I don't necessarily know that that means that therefore the basic motivations that people have in trying to achieve basic security or basic well-being or basic freedom, I'm not sure that has changed much.
I think from my perspective, for me, what makes it conflict complex today is our total lack of understanding of that conflict. We don't really understand the stakeholders, the motivations, the capabilities in Syria, and I think we have to be honest. Same, I think, goes for Iraq. Same certainly goes for Afghanistan.
You know, Matt, in one of the training videos, talks a bit about in the, quote, good old days, you know, you could address the actors in a conflict by having the Soviet premier and ambassadors and diplomats at a very elite levels of government come and discuss. And then, you know, people feel they get a sense of what's at stake and what are the interests at play in this conflict between these various countries. And now, if I'm hearing you correctly, Candace, it seems like it's no longer good enough to rely on folks and the conversations they have at those levels, that a lot of what is driving this conflict and you know, influencing its trajectory are folks who have no official title or don't have an official title that for the 50 years prior to that were titles that you would go to or you would listen to try and understand the conflict. And so do you feel like this is what's happening in Syria, that there are conversations happening amongst folks, but those aren't really the voices are the only voices that help us understand the dynamics of the conflict?
Look, I'm not a Syria expert, but my own perception is that we've had to play catch up the last 4 years as to the players we should be talking to, what they want and what their capabilities are. That was certainly the case throughout our 13, 14 years of engagement in Afghanistan, and I imagine it was the case in Iraq. I think we've been caught on the back foot more often than not, and I think for our intelligence communities, I think that's very difficult to accept.
Well, it's also, I think, in some cases, the players change, and there's sort of a shifting landscape that becomes difficult to keep up with. And you mentioned discussions. One of the things I think that has changed, it's that because there's so many non-state actors, it's much more difficult for discussions to occur. And how are different actors or stakeholders, particularly those who can do violence, how are they communicating? They're using sort of messaging, videos, social media as a way to communicate in ways that one might have done in previous times through discussion or negotiation. So it's a very different communication dynamic in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Love to hear from folks online as well. If you have experience working in what you would consider to be complex conflicts, what has that experience been like? We encourage you to share your stories and your perspectives. Candace, I want to go back to the 7 years that you spent in Afghanistan, but obviously post 9/11, there's been large-scale intervention in Afghanistan for a very long time. I mean, I think about it. I was early years in college when there was this, again, you know, large international intervention in Afghanistan, and it is still very much present. Were there ever conversations going on about, you know, how long are we going to be here? And I know I'm using the collective we, that represents a lot of institutions, countries, organizations, et cetera. Was that ever predicted that, you know, over a decade of engagement and intervention, that was going to be the case? And what role did analysis of the dynamics in Afghanistan play or not play in predicting that? Not that you can necessarily predict that, but I just feel like we've been in there a very long time. And was that something that folks were prepared for?
Well, the UN's been there since the early 1950s. The first UN humanitarian mission went there in the 1950s. It might have been WFP. I can't quite remember. And then, you know, we had the political mission when Najibullah was still president. UN missions are generally built to last. And it isn't until you get a new crisis that budgetary concerns become predominant, and then existing missions begin to lose money and they begin to lose staff, et cetera, et cetera. I think for my international colleagues in organizations such as ISAF, I think the shrewd colleagues knew that this will be a generational project. But I also think that with the surge in 2009 and American troop levels getting up to, I think it was 105,000, and ISAF overall getting up to 150,000, that the right decision was made to set out on paper an end date for that. Very, very large presence. But in terms of the UN presence beyond 2014, it will continue.
Were there occasions in which there were specific indicators that you would keep an eye on, that if, say, you know, poverty increased or schools were shut down or certain messages came out, were there indicators that you looked at that after, you know, experience that the UN had, that one could say, you know, we see this kind of this pattern of behavior, we can predict that there will be more violence?
Everyone knew there'd be more violence when the surge happened. That's just a given. You bring more troops into a country, there will be more violent acts against it. But in terms of indicators, they're notorious in Afghanistan. Very, very difficult to get statistics on the real situation inside the country. One thing that I was involved in was looking at security sector reform efforts in 2008 across the South, and this was very much driven by ISAF and the American contingent in terms of building Afghan police and army. And what we discovered in 08 and then in the 2 years beyond that, when I went up to Kabul and I headed a security sector reform team within the political affairs division, was that the way the recruitment and retention, the problems with recruitment and retention in the Afghan National Security Forces was actually driving a lot of conflict, because power brokers would try and capture their local police force and staff that police force with people loyal to them, thereby creating automatic conflict with groups that weren't represented, were now on the outside of that police force. And when the police force is setting up checkpoints and hitting people up for bribes, it's very much a driver of conflict.
We have a question from one of our listeners.
I do, and it's kind of a provocative one. So do you think there is any virtue in engaging violent extremist groups like ISIS or the Taliban in discussions or negotiations?
Can I answer that?
Go right ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we talk to whoever will want to talk to us. I wouldn't put the Taliban and ISIS in the same category. The Taliban has shown itself to be a little malleable, certainly more than it was 13, 14 years ago. I suspect that we will soon, eventually, be talking to people in Al-Qaeda, now that there's a very definite separation between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And one day, I imagine, we'll be talking to ISIS as well. You show me one example in history where people have said, we will never talk to the ANC. We will never talk to the PLO, the IRA, the Basques. We have ended up talking to every single one of them.
You know, this reminds me, that question and your response, Candace, reminds me of on the show, we interviewed Severine Autissier, who wrote the book Peaceland, Conflict Resolution and the Everyday Politics of International Intervention. And she talked about the importance of building relationships with all parties and actors in the conflict. And I raised the question of ISIS, ISIL, Islamic State, whatever they're called, and the issue of safety. So how do you build trust, going back to something we talked about earlier, develop a relationship with actors who are party to a group that commits horrific acts of violence and actually puts outsiders, others who are not part of their in-group, at great risk to their life and their health? How do you engage parties like that in gathering information, building those relationships, if your life can actually really be threatened?
Practicalities, you usually don't have a choice. What you're talking to at the very beginning are people two steps removed, for example, three steps removed from someone who might know someone even. It can be fairly long, the distance between you and the epicenter of violent extremism. I guess it's like peeling an onion. You just keep going inwards. Someone at my level, of course, wouldn't have been talking to people associated with senior leadership of the Taliban, but certainly our SRSG, former SRSG, Qaeda, was engaging with Taliban on humanitarian issues.
Another question, comment from our listeners.
Yes, we actually get to hear one of our listeners' voices.
Excellent.
Elizabeth?
Hi, this is Elizabeth Villarol. This is more of a comment posed to Candace and Jeff. I myself am an implementer in complex environments, and I'd like to ask, how does one course correct from your experience when conflict analysis and triangulation from not only observation but also empirical data are so far removed from the reality on the ground?
Well, look, I'm not sure there's a complete answer other than you talked about course correct. There has to be an openness to course correcting and not be locked into a particular framework or a particular pre-existing analysis of the situation. Being flexible, adaptable, being open-minded, and to also recognize that drivers of conflict and drivers or opportunities for building peace are shifting. And so any conflict analysis at any given point is merely a snapshot. And so you have to keep filling out, both looking back, understanding what's happened, and keep moving forward and not be wedded to, you know, saying, okay, this is what we know, and we're going to stop here, and we're going to base everything going forward on this particular analysis without being open to continuing to get more information and continue to reassess in that regard. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we've heard from those institutions that have developed conflict analysis frameworks, is their lack or their rigidity, I suppose. And so one of the challenges for us in this field is to think about how can you really have a flexible framework that is able to continue to build upon an ongoing assessment of new and shifting information and perspectives.
It's tricky because course correction often happens just as people are losing interest and moving on to somewhere else. And perhaps Elizabeth is referencing Afghanistan when she asks the question. There's no simple answer. I mean, I think we are quite rigid when it comes to shifting course.
So one kind of last question that I think will probably emerge and surface throughout the course is the practicality, the willingness, the time and effort that goes into conducting a robust conflict analysis that can be adapted and that will evolve with changing circumstances, a conflict analysis that involves the pre-deployment organizational self-assessment to local conflict analysis at the local personal level, to the larger national level, to the multinational level. I assume that most people say that's all fine and well, but, you know, I'm being deployed. We don't have time to do all this listening or all this gathering of information. We need to kind of operate and get stuff done based off of what we have. But to spend all this time gathering all this information through some, you know, process or framework, it's just not really workable. Has that been a sentiment that has been shared by some folks that you've worked with? Has there been resistance to conducting a conflict analysis and going through that type of process?
Yes. Although I think there's a greater recognition that it is worth investing in being prepared and doing this as much as you can in advance, being prepared before one deploys. But also then, and this gets to Candace's point about people losing interest, or you hear about donor fatigue, or you hear about, you know, what's the exit strategy, you know, and it's not just governments of the UN, it's about organizations themselves, international organizations. I think part of the issue is, do you have the capacity then to continue to do good assessment on the ground? So there's a importance of being prepared and understanding what you're getting into prior to entering the situation, but then having the capacity to continue to be responsive while one is working there and being able to step back. I mean, I think that's the problem sometimes, is that you get so immersed in the situation that you need to step back, have your assumptions challenged, bring in new perspectives, or just develop a framework or develop a way of analyzing that forces you to challenge your assumptions. If for no other reason, then that may validate what you've already believed, but you'll feel more confident about that going forward.
Candace, any concluding thoughts from you on the role that conflict analysis played or did not play in the 7 years you spent in Afghanistan?
No one gave me a PowerPoint framework and told me this was a conflict analysis. We were, you know, as a UN political officer, you sink or swim, and you soon develop an instinct for it. I'd say that the greatest virtue is longevity, although not too long. You start rolling your eyes. And then listening is also is very important.
things. You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace's Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I've been your host, Darren Cambridge, and I've been joined today by my co-host, Jeff Helsing, and our guest has been Candace Karp. Thanks to both of you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to all of you who tuned in and shared your questions and comments with us online. Our executive producer is Peter Weinberger. Our producers are Emily Mella, Vanessa Francis, and Leah Collins. Our sound engineers are Dominic Kirley and Blake Mobley. And our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. Tune in next week for the next episode of The Peace Frequency. Thanks.